in extent or in duration, with the long struggle of the early Christians against authority. For 3 centuries, Christianity was a persecuted religion, different from, sometimes opposed to, and often oppressed by the state authority. In the course of their long struggle, Christians developed a distinctive institution, the Church, with its own laws and courts, its own hierarchy and chain of authority. Christians sometimes speak of the synagogue and the mosque to denote the religious institutions of the Jewish and Muslim faiths. But these are inappropriate terms, the projection of Christian notions onto non-Christian religions. For the Jew or the Muslim, the synagogue or the mosque is a building, a place of worship and study, no more. Until modern times and the spread of Christian norms and influence, neither ever had, for its own worshippers, the institutional sense of the Christian term. The same may be said of the temples of other religions. The conversion of Constantine in the early 4th century and the establishment of Christianity as the state religion initiated a double change. The Christianization of Rome and, some would add, the Romanization of Christ. For the first time, Christians now held authority and had access to the coercive power of the state, which they promptly used to impose the newly formulated Roman Orthodoxy on the older churches of the East. But by this time, the Christian faith and the Christian church were centuries old, with their character sharply defined and indelibly marked by the experience of the founding generations. The Eastern churches had triumphed over pagan persecution. They endured Christian intolerance and more easily survived the later, milder disabilities imposed on them by Islam. Throughout Christian history, and in almost all Christian lands, church and state continued to exist side by side as different institutions, each with its own laws and jurisdictions, its own hierarchy and chain of authority. The two may be joined, or in modern times, separated. Their relationship may be one of cooperation, of confrontation, or of conflict. Sometimes they may be coequal. More often, one or the other may prevail in a struggle for the domination of the polity. In the course of the centuries, Christian jurists and theologians devised or adapted pairs of terms to denote this dichotomy of jurisdiction: sacred and profane, spiritual and temporal, religious and secular, ecclesiastical and lay. Muhammad was, so to speak, his own Constantine. In the religiously conceived polity that he founded and headed in Medina, the Prophet and his successors confronted the realities of the state and, before very long, of a vast and expanding empire. At no time did they create any institution corresponding to, or even remotely resembling, the Church in Christendom. But the tension between religious concerns and political needs was often felt, and the resulting polemics and conflicts are a recurring theme in Muslim history. The first 3 major civil wars in Islam, as narrated by Muslim chroniclers, appear as a series of unsuccessful attempts to steer the new Islamic state and community in a religiously defined direction. Pious ideals clashed with the needs of government, and soon of empire. Religious aspirations were sometimes seen as threatening the stability and continuity of the political society. The attempts to impose what one might call ecclesiastical constraints on political and military authority failed, causing the retreat of the pietists into either radical opposition or quietist withdrawal, accompanied by a certain disdain for public service. It is, for example, a topos of Islamic biography of men of religion in the Middle Ages that the pious hero of the narrative was offered an appointment by the ruler and refused it. The offer establishes his reputation, the refusal his piety. Connection with the state was somehow seen as demeaning, and the Qadi, appointed by the state, became a figure of ridicule in Islamic folklore. Less frequently, the attempt was also made the other way, when an Islamic ruler attempted to impose the rule of the state on religion, to choose a particular doctrine and enforce it. The best-known example was the Caliph Ma'mun, reigned 813 to 833 of the Common Era, who tried to create a sort of Erastian Islam. He and his successors failed, and the attempt was abandoned. Later, attempts were made by some Ottoman sultans and Persian shahs, but these were rare and atypical. Such terms as clergy or ecclesiastic cannot properly be applied to Muslim men of religion. These were, in time and in defiance of early tradition and precept, professionalized, and thus became a clergy in a sociological sense. They did not become a clergy in the theological sense. Islam recognizes no ordination, no sacraments, no priestly mediation between the believer and God. The so-called clergyman is perceived as a teacher, a guide, a scholar in theology and law, but not as a priest. If one may admit, in a limited professional sense, the existence of a clergy, there is no sense at all in which one can speak of a laity among Muslims. The idea that any group of persons, any kind of activities, any part of human life is in any sense outside the scope of religious law and jurisdiction is alien to Muslim thought. There is, for example, no distinction between canon law and civil law, between the law of the church and the law of the state, crucial in Christian history. There is only a single law, the Sharia, accepted by Muslims as of divine origin, and regulating all aspects of human life, civil, commercial, criminal, constitutional, as well as matters more specifically concerned with religion in the limited Christian sense of that word. In the upper house of the traditional British Parliament sat the Lords spiritual and temporal, the former being the bishops. In classical Islam, there are no Lords spiritual, no bishops, cardinals, popes, no councils, synods, or ecclesiastical courts. Nor do we find in Islamic history political churchmen like Cardinal Richelieu in France, Cardinal Wolsey in England, or Cardinal Alberoni in Spain. For the same reason, there was in classical Islam no hierarchy, though something of the sort has developed in more recent times under unavowed and no doubt unperceived Christian influence. One may even say that there is no orthodoxy and heresy, if one understands these terms in the Christian sense, as correct or incorrect belief defined as such by duly constituted religious authority. There has never been any such authority in Islam, and consequently no such definition. Where there are differences, they are between the mainstream and the fringes, between orthopraxy and deviation. Even the major division within Islam, between Sunnis and Shia, arose over an historical conflict about the political leadership of the community, not over any question of doctrine. The absence of a native secularism in Islam and the widespread Muslim rejection of an imported secularism inspired by Christian example may be attributed to certain profound differences of belief and experience in the two religious cultures. The first, and in many ways the most profound difference, from which all the others follow, can be seen in the contrasting foundation myths, I use this expression without intending any disrespect, of Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. The children of Israel fled from bondage and wandered for 40 years in the wilderness before they were permitted to enter the promised land. Their leader, Moses, had only a glimpse and was not himself permitted to enter. Jesus was humiliated and crucified, and his followers suffered persecution and martyrdom for centuries, before they were finally able to win over the ruler and to adapt the state, its language, and its institutions to their purpose. Muhammad achieved victory and triumph in his own lifetime. He conquered his promised land and created his own state, of which he himself was supreme sovereign. As such, he promulgated laws, dispensed justice, levied taxes, raised armies, made war, and made peace. In a word, he ruled, and the story of his decisions and actions as ruler is sanctified in Muslim scripture and amplified in Muslim tradition. When the Arab Muslims conquered a number of Roman provinces in the Levant and North Africa and Europe, they did not act like the Christianized barbarians from the north, who struggled to preserve something of the Roman state and its laws, and made use of the Latin and Greek languages in which their laws and scriptures were written. The Muslims brought their own scripture in their own language and created their own state, with their own sovereign institution and their own holy law. Since the state was Islamic and was indeed created as an instrument of Islam by its founder, there was no need for any separate religious institution. The state was the church, and the church was the state, and God was head of both, with the prophet as his representative on earth. In the words of an ancient and much-cited tradition, Islam, the ruler, and the people are like the tent, the pole, the ropes, and the pegs. The tent is Islam, the pole is the ruler, the ropes and pegs are the people. None can thrive without the others. After Muhammad's death, his spiritual mission was at an end, but his function of leadership, alike in its religious, its political, and its military aspects, was assumed by his successors or deputies, the caliphs. In the Muslim perception, there is no human legislative power, and there is only one law for the believers, the holy law of God, promulgated by revelation. This law could be amplified and interpreted by tradition and reasoning. It could not be changed, and no Muslim ruler could, in theory, either add or subtract a single rule. In fact, of course, they frequently did both, but their action in so doing was always suitably disguised. In time, with the growing complexity of Muslim law and doctrine, and the example of the older religions before them, the Muslims evolved a class of professional men of religion, the so-called ulama, those who possess ilm, religious knowledge. These were both jurists and theologians, the two being, in essence, branches of the same profession. At first sight, the classical Islamic order might seem to resemble the so-called Caesaropapism of Eastern Orthodox Christendom. The resemblance is more apparent than real. True, the Byzantine Basileus Autokrator, or the Russian Tsar, dominated the religious as well as the political establishments. But there was a patriarch, and under the patriarch, a hierarchy of metropolitans and bishops, and lesser ecclesiastical authorities, each with a delimited territorial and functional jurisdiction. There was no such hierarchy or delimitation of function in classical Islam, and when a semblance of such an order began to appear in the Ottoman Empire, it was clearly a response to the influences of a predominantly Christian environment. Another relevant difference between Islamic and Christian political notions is the survival, and latterly revival, in the Islamic world, of the religious basis of identity, which, in Christian Europe, was to a large extent replaced by the territorial or ethnic nation-state. Nations and countries, of course, existed in the Islamic world, and there is much evidence in the literature of a sense of ethnic, cultural, and occasionally regional identity. But at no time were these seen as forming the basis of statehood or of political identity and allegiance. In the vast and rich historiographic literature of Islam, there are basically three kinds of historical topic. There are universal histories, meaning, with few exceptions, the history of the Islamic ecumen and the caliphs and sultans who ruled over it. There are dynastic histories, focused on a ruling family and covering the often extremely variable territories over which it ruled. There are local or regional histories, most commonly of a city and the immediately surrounding district. These last are primarily topographical and biographical. There are no histories, however, of the Arabs or of Arabia, of the Turks or of Turkey, of the Iranians or of Iran. These are very ancient entities, but very modern notions. And in the 19th and 20th centuries, when, under the impact of new ideas and pressures from abroad, Muslims began to define themselves and their loyalties in national and patriotic terms, it is surely significant that in Arabic, Persian, and Turkish alike, the words used to designate the nation are words that had previously been used to designate the religious polity of Islam, and this despite the available choice of a number of words of primarily ethnic or territorial content. The reasons why Muslims developed no secularist movement of their own and reacted sharply against attempts to introduce one from abroad will thus be clear from the contrasts between Christian and Muslim history and experience. From the beginning, Christians were taught both by precept and practice to distinguish between God and Caesar, and between the different duties owed to each of the two. Muslims received no such instruction. The history of Christianity is much concerned with schism and heresy, and with the conflicts in which the proponents of competing doctrines and the wielders of rival authority struggled to overcome each other, by persecution when this was feasible, by war when it was not. The story begins almost immediately after the conversion of Constantine, with the Christological and jurisdictional conflicts between the churches of Constantinople, Antioch, and Alexandria. It continued with the struggle between Constantinople and Rome, the later struggle between the papacy and the Protestants, and the further conflicts between different groups of the latter, until, after centuries of bloody strife and persecution, growing numbers of Christians finally concluded that only by depriving the churches of access to the coercive and repressive powers of the state, and by depriving the state of the power to intervene in the affairs of the church, could they achieve any tolerable coexistence between people of differing faiths and creeds. The Muslim experience was very different. Muslims had, of course, their religious disagreements, and these on occasion led to strife and repression. But there is nothing remotely comparable with such epoch-making Christian events as the Schism of Photius, the Reformation, the Holy Office of the Inquisition, and the bloody religious wars of the 16th and 17th centuries, which almost compelled Christians to secularize their states and societies in order to escape from the vicious circle of persecution and conflict. Muslims encountered no such problem, and therefore required no such answer. The first Muslim encounter with secularism was in the French Revolution, which they saw not as secular, a word and concept equally meaningless to them at that time, but as de-Christianized, and therefore deserving of some consideration. All previous movements of ideas in Europe had been, to a greater or lesser extent, Christian, at least in their expression, and were accordingly discounted in advance from a Muslim point of view. The French Revolution was the first movement of ideas in Europe that was seen as non-Christian, or even anti-Christian, and some Muslims therefore looked to France in the hope of finding in these ideas the motors of Western science and progress, freed from Christian encumbrances. These ideas provided the main ideological inspiration of many of the modernizing and reforming movements in the Islamic world in the 19th and early 20th centuries. From the beginning, there were a few who saw that these ideas could threaten not only Christianity, but also Islam, and who gave warning against them. For a long time, they had little influence. The minority who were at all aware of European ideas were, for the most part, profoundly attracted by them. Among the vast majority, the challenge of Western secular ideas was not so much opposed as ignored. It is only in comparatively recent times that Muslim religious thinkers of stature have looked at secularism, understood its threat to what they regard as the highest values of religion, and responded with a decisive rejection. The strangeness of these ideas to Muslims can be seen in the struggle to find appropriate terms to designate them. The Turks were the first Muslim people to attempt some study of the West, and to devise or adapt terms for Western notions and artifacts. The earliest Turkish discussions of secularism use the term ladini, literally, non-religious. This is easily confused with irreligious, and Turkish secularists soon realized that the term they had chosen was unnecessarily provocative. They therefore replaced it with a loan word from French, laïc, which in its Turkish form, laïc, remains in use to the present time. The same word is now used in Persian, but not in Arabic. The Arabs had a rather easier task, since Arabic, unlike Turkish and Persian, is a Christian as well as a Muslim language. In several Middle Eastern countries, there are or were sizable Arabic-speaking Christian communities who produced a substantial Christian Arabic literature and devised the necessary Arabic vocabulary to render Christian terms. For a long time, the Christians of the Fertile Crescent wrote the Arabic language in the Syriac script, just as the Jews wrote it in the Hebrew script, and both Judeo-Arabic and Judeo-Christian literatures were unknown to the Muslims. Even after the Christians began to use the common Arabic script, their literature for a while remained a largely internal affair. But with the spread of European influence from the 19th century, Arabic-speaking Christians, often educated in Western schools and more open to Western ideas, played a key role in their transmission, and the Christian Arab lexicon provided a significant part of the new vocabulary that went to make up modern Arabic. One of these Christian terms that passed into common usage was al-Lamani, later also al-Lamani, literally meaning worldly, from al-Lam, world. This word served as the equivalent of temporal, secular, and lay alike. A later loan translation, ruhani, from ruh, spirit, served as its counterpart. More recently, its Christian origin and etymology forgotten, al-Lamani, has been revocalized ilmani, derived from ilm, science, and misunderstood to denote the doctrine of those who presume to pit human science against divine revelation. It has become a favorite blanket term used by both radical and traditional religious writers to denote what they see as foreign, neo-pagan, and generally anti-Islamic ideas imported by Western propagandists and missionaries and their local dupes and agents to subvert Islamic society and end the rule of the Sharia. The source of this evil is variously located in Europe or America, in Judaism, Christianity, and communism. The solution is the same for all of these: to remove the alien and pagan laws and customs imposed by foreign imperialists and native reformers, and restore the only true law, the all-embracing law of God. The proponents of this doctrine won power in Iran in 1979. They are increasingly a force to be reckoned with in other Muslim countries. In the secularization of the West, God was twice dethroned and replaced, as the source of sovereignty by the people, as the object of worship by the nation. Both of these ideas were alien to Islam, but in the course of the 19th century they became more familiar, and in the 20th they became dominant among the westernized intelligentsia, who, for a while, ruled many, if not most, Muslim states. In a nation-state defined by the country over which it ruled, or the nation that constituted its population, a secular state was, in principle, possible. Only one Muslim state, the Turkish Republic, formally adopted secularism as a principle, and enacted the removal of Islam from the constitution and the abrogation of the Sharia, which ceased to be part of the law of the land. The six former Soviet republics of predominantly Muslim population inherited a rigorously secular system, except in the sense that communism was an established faith. So far, most of them show little inclination to Islamize their laws and institutions. One or two other Muslim countries went some of the way toward separation, and several more restricted Sharia law to marriage, divorce, and inheritance, and adopted modern, mostly West European laws in other matters. More recently, there has been a strong reaction against these changes. A whole series of Islamic radical and militant movements, loosely and inaccurately designated as fundamentalist, share the objective of undoing the secularizing reforms of the last century, abolishing the imported codes of law and the social customs that came with them, and returning to the holy law of Islam and an Islamic political order. In three countries, Iran, Afghanistan, and Sudan, these forces have gained power. In several others, they exercise growing influence, and a number of governments have begun to reintroduce Sharia law, whether from conviction or, among the more conservative regimes, as a precaution. Even nationalism and patriotism, which, after some initial opposition from pious Muslims, had begun to be generally accepted, are now once again questioned and sometimes even denounced as anti-Islamic. In some Arab countries, defenders of what has by now become the old-style secular nationalism accuse the Islamic fundamentalists of dividing the Arab nation and setting Muslim against Christian. The fundamentalists reply that it is the nationalists who are divisive, by setting Turk against Persian, against Arab, within the larger community of Islam, and that theirs is the greater and more heinous offence. In the literature of the Muslim radicals and militants, the enemy has been variously defined. Sometimes he is the Jew or Zionist, sometimes the Christian or missionary, sometimes the Western imperialist, sometimes, less frequently, the Russian or other communist. But their primary enemies and the most immediate object of their campaigns and attacks are the native secularizers, those who have tried to weaken or modify the Islamic basis of the state by introducing secular schools and universities, secular laws and courts, and thus excluding Islam and its professional exponents from the two major areas of education and justice. The arch enemy for most of them is Kemal Atatürk, the founder of the Turkish Republic and the first great secularizing reformer in the Muslim world. Characters as diverse as King Farouk and Presidents Nasser and Sadat in Egypt, Hafez al-Assad in Syria, and Saddam Hussein in Iraq, the Shah of Persia, and the kings and princes of Arabia were denounced as the most dangerous enemies of Islam, the enemies from within. The issue was defined with striking clarity in a widely circulated booklet by Mohammed Abd al-Salam Faraj, the ideological guide of the group that murdered President Sadat of Egypt. Fighting the near enemy is more important than fighting the distant enemy. In jihad, the blood of the Muslims must flow until victory is achieved. But the question now arises, is this victory for the benefit of an existing Islamic state, or is it for the benefit of the existing infidel regime? And is it a strengthening of the foundation of this regime which deviates from the law of God? These rulers only exploit the opportunity offered to them by the nationalist ideas of some Muslims in order to accomplish purposes which are not Islamic, despite their outward appearance of Islam. The struggle of a jihad must be under Muslim auspices and under Muslim leadership, and concerning this there is no dispute. The cause of the existence of imperialism in the lands of Islam lies in these self-same rulers. To begin the struggle against imperialism would be a work that is neither glorious nor useful, but only a waste of time. It is our duty to concentrate on our Islamic cause, which means first and foremost establishing God's law in our own country and causing the word of God to prevail. There can be no doubt that the first battlefield of the jihad is the extirpation of these infidel leaderships and their replacement by a perfect Islamic order. From this will come release. At the present time, secularism is in a bad way in the Middle East. Of those Middle Eastern states that have written constitutions, only two have no established religion. One is Lebanon, no longer an encouraging example of religious tolerance or secularization. The other, as already noted, is the Turkish Republic, where, while the general principle of separation is maintained, there has been some erosion. The ex-Soviet republics are still struggling with these problems. Of the remaining Middle Eastern countries, those that possess written constitutions all give some constitutional status to Islam, ranging from the Islamic Republic of Iran, which gives religion a central position, to the rather minimal reference in the Syrian constitution, which says the laws of the state shall be inspired by the Sharia. Of the states without written constitutions, principally Israel and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, both accord a very considerable place to religion in the definition of identity and of loyalty. If one may briefly compare the two, Saudi Arabia gives a greater place to the application of religious law. Israel allows a far greater political role to the clergy. I have used the word clergy. It is, of course, a Christian word, alien to both the Muslim and Jewish traditions, but very much part of present-day Muslim and Jewish realities. This is the result of a long development, the beginnings of which one can see in the Ottoman ecclesiastical hierarchy. In the Ottoman state, there was what is sometimes called the religious institution, a hierarchy of religious authorities with territorial jurisdictions, almost equivalent to the see or diocese of a Christian bishop. The appointment of a mufti of a place, with jurisdiction over a territorially defined entity, dates from Ottoman times, and almost certainly follows Christian example or responds to Christian influence. Not only were there muftis of places, but there was a hierarchy of muftis, culminating in the chief mufti of Istanbul, whom one might reasonably describe as the primate of the Ottoman Empire, the Muslim archbishop of the capital. Even after the fall of the Ottoman Empire, the practice continued in the Ottoman successor states in the Middle East, where governments appointed functionaries with the title Chief Mufti, exercising religious, one might even say ecclesiastical, jurisdiction over a city, a province, or a country, and playing a political role unknown in classical Islam. One sees it even more dramatically in the Ayatollahs of Iran, a title dating from quite modern times and unknown to classical Islamic history. If the rulers of the Islamic Republic but knew it, what they are doing is Christianizing Islam in an institutional sense, though not, of course, in any religious sense. They have already endowed Iran with the functional equivalents of a pontificate, a college of cardinals, a bench of bishops, and, especially, an inquisition, all previously alien to Islam. They may, in time, provoke a reformation. For more than 1,000 years, Islam provided the only universally acceptable set of rules and principles for the regulation of public and social life. Even during the period of maximum European influence, in the countries ruled or dominated by European imperial powers, as well as in those that remained independent, Islamic political notions and attitudes remained a profound and pervasive influence. In recent years, there have been many signs that these notions and attitudes may be returning, albeit in much modified forms, to their previous dominance. The term civil society has become very popular in recent years and is used in a number of different, sometimes overlapping, sometimes conflicting senses. It may therefore be useful to examine Islamic perceptions of civility, according to various definitions of that term. Perhaps the primary meaning of civil in the Middle East today is as the converse of military. This has a special relevance in a place and at a time when the professional officer corps is often both the source and the instrument of power. In this sense, Islamic society, in its inception and in its early formative years, was unequivocally civil. The Prophet and the early caliphs employed no professional soldiers, but relied for military duties on a kind of armed, mostly voluntary militia. It is not until the 2nd century of the Islamic era, 8th century of the Common Era, that one can speak with certitude of a professional army. The caliph, who in early, though not in later times, occasionally commanded his armies, was nevertheless a civilian. So too was the wazir, who, under the caliph's authority, was in charge of all branches of the government, both civil and military. The wazir's emblem of office was an inkpot, which was carried before him on ceremonial public occasions. In the later Middle Ages, internal upheavals and external invasions brought changes, which resulted in the militarization of most Islamic regimes. This has persisted to modern times. During the late 19th and early 20th centuries, there was an interlude of civilian, more or less constitutional, government, mostly on Western models. During the 1950s and after, these regimes, for the most part, came to an end, and were replaced by authoritarian governments under ultimate military control. This is, however, by no means universal. In some countries, as, for example, Saudi Arabia, traditional monarchies still maintain a traditional civilian order. In others, like Turkey and later Egypt, the military themselves prepared the way for a return to civilian government. On the whole, the prospects for civilianization at the present time seem to be reasonably good. In the more generally accepted interpretation of the term civil society, civil is opposed not to religious or to military authority, but to authority as such. In this sense, the civil society is that part of society between the family and the state in which the mainsprings of association, initiative, and action are voluntary, determined by opinion or interest or other personal choice, and distinct from, though they may be influenced by, the loyalty owed by birth and the obedience imposed by force. Obvious modern examples are the business corporation, the trade union, the professional association, the learned society, the club or lodge, the sports team, and the political party. Islamic precept, as presented by the jurists and theologians, and Islamic practice, as reflected by the historians, offer a variety of sometimes contradictory precedents. The tradition of private charity is old and deep-rooted in Islam, and is given legal expression in the institution of waf. A waf is a pious endowment in mortmain, consisting of some income-producing asset, the proceeds of which are dedicated to a pious purpose, the upkeep of a place of worship, a school, a bathhouse, a soup kitchen, a water fountain, and the like. The donor might be a ruler or government official. He might equally be, and very often was, a private person. Women who, in Islamic law, have the right to own and dispose of property figure prominently among founders of wafs, sometimes reaching almost half the number. This is perhaps the only area in the traditional Muslim society in which they approach equality with men. By means of the institution of waf, many services which in other systems are the principal or sole responsibility of the state were provided by private initiative. One of the major changes brought by modernizing autocrats in the 19th century was to bring the wafs under state control. In this and other ways, modernization in the Middle East has reduced, not increased, the scope for independent and self-supporting associations, and the encroachment of the reinforced modern state has inhibited the development of a real civil society. In the cultural sphere, the state disposes of new and stronger instruments to control the schools, the media, and in general the printed word. This control will no doubt in time be undermined by the electronic media revolution, but for the time being at least it remains effective. In the economy, even after the collapse and abandonment of socialism, state involvement in economic life continues. In most countries in the region, a very large proportion of the population depends directly or indirectly on the state for its income. Many of the remainder eke out a precarious and inadequate livelihood from smuggling and other illicit transactions, all part of an extensive black market economy in which members of the state apparatus may in various ways be gainfully involved. Islamic law, unlike Roman law and its derivatives, does not recognize corporate legal persons, and there are therefore no Islamic equivalents to such Western corporate entities as the city, the monastery, or the college. Cities were mostly governed by royal officers, while convents and colleges relied on royal or private wafs. There were, however, other groupings of considerable vitality and importance in traditional Muslim society. Such, for example, are the kin group, family, clan, tribe, the faith group, often linked together by common membership of a Sufi fraternity, the craft group, joined in a guild, the ward or neighborhood within a city. Very often these groups overlapped or even coincided, and much of the life of a Muslim city was determined by their interaction. In the Islamic context, the independence and initiative of the civil society may best be measured not in relation to the state, but in relation to religion, of which, in the Muslim perception, the state itself is a manifestation and an instrument. In this sense, the primary meaning of civil is non-religious, and the civil society is one in which the organizing principle is something other than religion, that being a private affair of the individual. The first European country that actually accorded civil rights to non-Christians was Holland, followed within a short time by England and the English colonies in North America, where extensive, though not as yet equal, rights were granted to non-conformist Christians and to Jews. These examples were followed by others, and the libertarian ideas they expressed contributed significantly to the ideologies of both the American and French revolutions. In time, these ideas were almost universally accepted in Western Christendom. Though few states, other than France and the United States, accepted a formal constitutional separation of religion and the state, most of them observe it in practice. In the Islamic world, the dethronement of religion as the organizing principle of society was not attempted until much later, and the attempt was due entirely to European influences. It was never really completed, and is perhaps now being reversed. Certainly in Iran, organized religion has returned to something like the status that it enjoyed in the medieval world, both Christian and Islamic. During the 14 centuries of Islamic history, there have been many changes. In particular, the long association, sometimes in coexistence, more often in confrontation with Christendom, led to the acceptance in the later Islamic monarchies in Iran and Turkey and their successor states of patterns of religious organization that might suggest a probably unconscious imitation of Christian ecclesiastical usage. These Western influences became more powerful and more important after the French Revolution. The dissemination of French revolutionary ideas in the Islamic world was not left to chance, but was actively promoted by successive French regimes, both by force of arms and, much more effectively, by translation and publication. The penetration of Western ideas into the Islamic world was greatly accelerated when, from the early 19th century, Muslim students in increasing numbers were sent to the institutions of higher education in France, Italy, and Britain, and later also in other countries. Many of these, on their return home, became carriers of infectious new ideas. Until the impact of these ideas, the notion of a non-religious society as something desirable or even permissible was totally alien to Islam. Other religious dispensations, namely Christianity and Judaism, were tolerable because they were earlier and superseded versions of God's revelation, of which Islam itself was the final and perfect version, and therefore lived by a form, albeit incomplete and perhaps debased, of God's law. Those who lacked even this measure of religious guidance were pagans and idolaters, and their society or polity was evil. Any Muslim who sought to join them or imitate them was an apostate. One of the tests of civility is surely tolerance, a willingness to coexist with those who hold and practice other beliefs. John Locke, and most other Westerners, believed that the best way to ensure this was to sever or at least to weaken the bonds between religion and the state power. In the past, Muslims never professed any such belief. They did, however, see a certain form of tolerance as an obligation of the dominant Islamic religion. "There is no compulsion in religion," runs a much-quoted verse in the Quran, chapter 2, verse 256. And this was generally interpreted by Muslim jurists and rulers to authorize a limited measure of tolerance for certain specified other religious beliefs, without, of course, in any way questioning or compromising the primacy of Islam and the supremacy of the Muslims. Does this mean that the classical Islamic state was a theocracy? In the sense that Britain today is a monarchy, the answer is certainly yes. That is to say that, in the Muslim conception, God is the true sovereign of the community, the ultimate source of authority, the sole source of legislation. In the first extant Muslim account of the British House of Commons, written by a visitor who went to England at the end of the 18th century, the writer expresses his astonishment at the fate of a people who, unlike the Muslims, did not have a divine revealed law, and were therefore reduced to the pitiable expedient of enacting their own laws. But in the sense of a state ruled by the church or by priests, Islam was not, and indeed could not be, a theocracy. In this sense, classical Islam had no priesthood, no prelates who might rule or even decisively influence those who did. The caliph, who was head of a governing institution that was state and church in one, was himself neither a jurist nor a theologian, but a practitioner of the arts of politics and sometimes of war. The office of Ayatollah is a creation of the 19th century. The rule of Khomeini and of his successor as supreme jurist, an innovation of the 20th. In most tests of tolerance, Islam, both in theory and in practice, compares unfavorably with the Western democracies as they have developed during the last two or three centuries, but very favorably with most other Christian and post-Christian societies and regimes. There is nothing in Islamic history to compare with the emancipation, acceptance, and integration of other believers and non-believers in the West. But equally, there is nothing in Islamic history to compare with the Spanish expulsion of Jews and Muslims, the Inquisition, the auto-da-fés, the wars of religion, not to speak of more recent crimes of commission and acquiescence. There were occasional persecutions, but they were rare, and usually of brief duration, related to local and specific circumstances. Within certain limits and subject to certain restrictions, Islamic governments were willing to tolerate the practice, though not the dissemination, of other revealed monotheistic religions. They were able to pass an even severer test by tolerating divergent forms of their own. Even polytheists, though condemned by the strict letter of the law to a choice between conversion and enslavement, were in fact tolerated, as Islamic rule spread to most of India. Only the total unbeliever, the agnostic or atheist, was beyond the pale of tolerance, and even this exclusion was usually only enforced when the offence became public and scandalous. The same standard was applied in the tolerance of deviant forms of Islam. In modern times, Islamic tolerance has been somewhat diminished. After the second Turkish siege of Vienna in 1683, Islam was a retreating, not an advancing force in the world, and Muslims began to feel threatened by the rise and expansion of the great Christian empires of Eastern and Western Europe. The old, easygoing tolerance, resting on an assumption not only of superior religion, but also of superior power, was becoming difficult to maintain. The threat that Christendom now seemed to be offering to Islam was no longer merely military and political. It was beginning to shake the very structure of Muslim society. Western rulers, and, to a far greater extent, their enthusiastic Muslim disciples and imitators, brought in a whole series of reforms, almost all of them of Western origin or inspiration, which increasingly affected the way Muslims lived in their countries, their cities and villages, and finally, in their own homes. These changes were rightly seen as being of Western origin or inspiration. The non-Muslim minorities, mostly Christian but also Jewish, were often seen, sometimes also rightly, as agents or instruments of these changes. The old pluralistic order, multi-denominational and polyethnic, was breaking down, and the tacit social contract on which it was based was violated on both sides. The Christian minorities, inspired by Western ideas of self-determination, were no longer prepared to accept the tolerated but inferior status accorded to them by the old order, and made new demands, sometimes for equal rights within the nation, sometimes for separate nationhood, sometimes for both at the same time. Muslim majorities, feeling mortally threatened, became unwilling to accord even the traditional measure of tolerance. By a sad paradox, in some of the semi-secularized nation-states of modern times, the non-Muslim minorities, while enjoying complete equality on paper, in fact have fewer opportunities and face greater dangers than under the old Islamic yet pluralistic order. The present regime in Iran, with its ruling clerics, its executions for blasphemy, its consecrated assassins, represents a new departure in Islamic history. In the present mood, a triumph of militant Islam would be unlikely to bring a return to traditional Islamic tolerance, and even that would no longer be acceptable to minority elements schooled on modern ideas of human, civil, and political rights. The emergence of some form of civil society would therefore seem to offer the best hope for decent coexistence based on mutual respect. Secularism in the Christian world was an attempt to resolve the long and destructive struggle of church and state. Separation, adopted in the American and French revolutions and elsewhere after that, was designed to prevent two things: the use of religion by the state to reinforce and extend its authority, and the use of the state power by the clergy to impose their doctrines and rules on others. This is a problem long seen as purely Christian, not relevant to Muslims, or for that matter to Jews, for whom a similar problem has arisen in Israel. Looking at the contemporary Middle East, both Muslim and Jewish, one must ask whether this is still true, or whether Muslims and Jews may perhaps have caught a Christian disease and might, therefore, consider a Christian remedy. Chapter 6. Time, Space, and Modernity. In a letter written in 1554, Ogier Giselin du Busbecq, ambassador from the emperor to the sultan, describes a problem he encountered on his journey to the Ottoman capital. There remained one annoyance, which was almost worse than a lack of wine, namely that our sleep used to be interrupted in a most distressing manner. We often had to rise early, sometimes even before it was light, in order to arrive in good time at more convenient halting places. The result was that our Turkish guides were sometimes deceived by the brightness of the moon and waked us with a loud clamour soon after midnight. For the Turks have no hours to mark the time, just as they have no milestones to mark distances. They have, it is true, a class of men called talismans, attached to the service of their mosques, who make use of water clocks. When they judge from these that dawn is at hand, they raise a shout from a high tower erected for the purpose, in order to exhort and invite men to say their prayers. They repeat the performance halfway between sunrise and midday, again at midday, and halfway between midday and sunset, and finally at sunset, uttering in a tremulous voice shrill but not unpleasing cries, which are audible at a greater distance than one would imagine possible. Thus,